Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, More Than Meets the Eye, we have our weekly reflection on the Sunday Gospel reading, prepared by Jill Bevilacqua, and Minting and Printing. We shine the spotlight on the long and fascinating history of papal coins and medals and Vatican stamps. As usual, we begin today's broadcast with Jill Bevilacqua's programme. There's more in the Sunday Gospel than meets the eye.
When Jesus saw the crowds, he went up on the mountainside. After he had sat down, his disciples gathered around him, and he began to teach them. How blessed are the poor in spirit. The reign of God is theirs. Blessed too are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. Blessed are the lowly. They shall inherit the land. Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for holiness. They shall have their fill. Blessed are they who show mercy. Mercy shall be theirs. Blessed are the single-hearted, for they shall see God. Blessed too the peacemakers, they shall be called sons of God. Blessed are those persecuted for holiness' sake, the reign of God is theirs. Blessed are you when they insult you and persecute you, and utter every kind of slander against you because of me. Be glad and rejoice, for your reward in heaven is great.
If there is any passage of the New Testament which could be called Christ's manifesto, it's surely the one we've just heard. It's so familiar to us that revolutionary seems an exaggerated description. And yet this programme for a new way of living was more subversive than anything Marx could have dreamed of. Nor did Jesus sit quietly writing down his ideas in the seclusion of the reading room of a great library. On the contrary, he proclaimed them from a hilltop. Or so Matthew writes. Luke suggests that he had come down onto the plain. But let's go back a bit in time, to the previous night.
Now it was about this time that he went out into the hills to pray, and he spent the whole night in prayer to God. When day came, he summoned his disciples and picked out 12 of them. He called them apostles. He then came down with them and stopped at a piece of level ground, where there was a large gathering of his disciples with a great crowd of people from all parts of Judea and from Jerusalem and from the coastal region of Tyre and Sidon.
As usual then, with the evangelists, we have an event recounted as happening in two different places, up on a hill, down on the plain. Perhaps if our Lord had been a Greek and lived in ancient times, he would have stood in the theatre at Epidaurus, where you can be heard by the whole audience, even those sitting right at the top, what we'd call the gallery, and he wouldn't have needed to raise his voice. But not only do Luke and Matthew set the scene differently, they also precede what we know as the Sermon on the Mount with different events. While Luke recounts the choosing of the 12 as taking place immediately before, Matthew only has Peter, Andrew, James and John called from their fishing. Finally, the Beatitudes themselves are presented differently by the two writers. But neither the place nor the order of events matters to our evangelists. Only what Jesus said or did. And as for the order in which he said things, this too is irrelevant. St. Augustine puts it best.
Anyone can see There's no point in asking in what order our Lord uttered these words, for we cannot fail to discover, on the most excellent authority, that of the evangelists themselves, that there is no failure of truth in giving a sermon in an order different from that in which it was first uttered. Whether the order was thus or thus makes no difference to the substance of what was said.
In the year 1187 AD, the Second Crusade, preached by St. Bernard, ended in failure when the Muslim Saladin captured Jerusalem, defeating the Crusaders on the mountain known as the Horns of Hattin. Situated to the west of the Sea of Galilee, or Lake of Tiberias, and rising to about 1,000 feet, it was, the Crusaders believed, where Jesus had preached the Beatitudes. But the shrine which stands on the Mount of the Beatitudes is not there, but further north. And as we read in the guidebook,
from it one can enjoy on the Lake of Tiberias one of the most wonderful views in Galilee. On the right it dominates the town of Tiberias, and below, at the foot of the shrine, there is Tabgha, with the shrine of the multiplication of loaves, and the shrine which commemorates the conferring of the primacy of Peter after the resurrection.
In 1964, Pope Paul VI came to the chapel at Tabgha, built over the rock where the first pope received the keys of the kingdom. Where the Sermon on the Mount was given, we have seen, is unimportant, but Jesuit Father Peter Rieger notes,
the mountain is mentioned since it's a parallel to the original mountain of Mount Sinai, where the first law was given to the chosen people. Christ is here represented as the new Moses, who gives the perfect law of the gospel. The crowds are not only Jews, but also people from Syria and the surrounding regions, which presumably includes pagans. Thus, the future universal nature of the missionary vocation of the disciples to all peoples is here implied. Through the disciples, Christ addresses himself to the whole world.
And now, before we leave the image of hill or mount to consider the Beatitudes themselves, let's listen to these lines by the Dutch artist Jan de Foe, based on an ancient poem known as the Song of Amergin. The theme is contemporary, that everyone should pay respect to and take responsibility for the environment they inhabit. The manuscript of the original poem, said to date back to 1268 BC, is in the library of the Royal Irish Academy in Dublin.
I am a hill where poets walk, mountain surrounded by dancing signs, words, lines of dreams, unspoken in daily happening, past and future intertwined, wild ranks of ever-growing green, reaching outward, down and upward, seeking the sounds of birds singing in the cold of winter's night.
Many interpretations have been given to the Beatitudes, many the explanations of their meaning and message. None can be definitive. So I've made an arbitrary choice of the thoughts of a few people on some of the Beatitudes. First, we should perhaps define Beatitude itself. Supreme blessedness, perfect felicity, say the dictionaries. And this, which seems to come closest, the special blessedness announced in the Sermon on the Mount. Special indeed, above all, in its total unexpectedness. The first of the Beatitudes is probably also the most discussed. How blessed or how happy are the poor in spirit? But, writes Carlo Carretto,
who can claim to be poor in the biblical sense? The man who comes to understand, under the pressure of suffering or in the light of God, what it means to be human. The man who discovers his own limitations, who enters into the mystery of what it means to be a creature rather than a creator. Anyone, that is, who knows he is sick, small, weak, vulnerable, ignorant, sinful, needful of everything, who stands at the mercy of history and of wickedness in high places. Prisoner of hostile circumstances, who has learnt humility and discretion from the pain and anguish of his experience, who is thirsting for help and for love. The poor man, in short, is the man who has discovered his own limitations. He is blessed, and he becomes blessed, if he accepts such limitations as coming to him from the hand of God, in order that the kingdom might become a reality within him.
Few people can have been so close to the poor as Mother Teresa, now blessed in more ways than one. In 1982, after frequent meetings with Mother Teresa in Rome and in Calcutta, Sean Patrick Lovett compiled a book of her meditations. Here, in an exclusive and historic recording, are her thoughts on "Happy the pure in heart, they shall see God." In the version we heard today, "Blessed are the single-hearted," but somehow the word "pure" has a force all its own.
A pure heart is a heart that serves, a pure heart that is free to give, to love until it hurts. A pure heart can easily see Christ in the hungry, in the naked, in the homeless, in the lonely, in the unwanted, in the unloved, in the leper, in the alcoholic, the man lying in the street, unwanted, unloved, hungry. Because there is not only hunger for bread, there is hunger for love. There is not only nakedness for a piece of cloth, but there is that nakedness for that human dignity. It's not only homelessness for a small house to live in, but that homelessness of being abandoned by all, unwanted, unloved, uncared, having forgotten what is human love, what is human joy, what is human touch.
Blessed, too, are the sorrowing. They shall be consoled. A brief reflection on this theme comes from Andrew Jukes, a 19th century Anglican deacon.
I can tell you for an eternal truth that troubled souls are always safe. It is the untroubled that are in danger. Trouble in itself is always a claim on love, and God is love. He must deny himself if he does not come to help the helpless. It is the prisoners and the blind and the leper and the possessed and the hungry and the tempest-tossed who are his special care. Therefore, if you are lost and sick and bound, you are just in the place where he can meet you. Blessed are the mourners. They shall be comforted.
And what of the peacemakers? Surely they, in our war-torn world, are precious among the blessed. How many of them, though, have been eliminated by the violent? In the last half-century alone, the names multiply. Mahatma Gandhi, great soul, 1948. Martin Luther King, 1968. Anwar Sadat, 1981. And in more recent times, Yitzhak Rabin. Back in 1926, Gandhi had written,
"Non-violence is not a garment to be put on and off at will. Its seat is in the heart, and it must be an inseparable part of our very being.
In his book, Strength to Love, Martin Luther King tells of how he discovered the life and teachings of Gandhi.
I came to see for the first time that the Christian doctrine of love, operating through the Gandhian method of non-violence, is one of the most potent weapons available to an oppressed people in their struggle for freedom.
When the bus boycott began in Montgomery, Alabama, where King had been pastor for a year or so, the people asked him to act as their spokesman.
In accepting this responsibility, my mind, consciously or unconsciously, was driven back to the Sermon on the Mount and the Gandhian method of non-violent resistance. This principle became the guiding light of our movement. Christ furnished the spirit and motivation, and Gandhi furnished the method.
Blessed be the peacemakers. They shall be called sons of God.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program.
The history of papal coinage goes back nearly 1,300 years, and the coins struck often reflect the colourful and sometimes turbulent history of the papacy over the centuries. Since 1929, the Vatican City State has issued sets of commemorative coins and stamps several times a year that have become prized items for collectors around the globe. After the advent of the euro, the Vatican was granted the right in 2001 to issue its own euro coins. There is also a Vatican Philatelic and Numismatic Museum that attracts many visitors each year. Founded in 2007, the museum showcased the entire Vatican City State stamp and coin production from 1929 to present. Peter Jensis is a US numismatist who specializes in Vatican coins and also acts as a dealer for the tiny state stamps. He says the Vatican's commemorative stamp issues are always very popular with collectors.
Oh, there's a high level of interest in each new issue. I think the Vatican chooses its themes and its designs very carefully, often selecting special artists to do the work. And these stamps, of course, are available for sale at the Vatican itself.
So they're very much prized by collectors. And does that mean collectors all over the world, or is it mainly in the West?
Well, I think Vatican stamps pull in collectors from throughout the world. The U.S. maybe can be a little special. Germany certainly shows a lot of interest in the stamps of Vatican City. But as a special nation, it draws collectors from throughout the world.
What have been, to your knowledge, the most valuable or striking or unusual set of stamps ever issued by the Vatican that have really, you know, made their mark on history?
Well, the most valuable set of stamps is from 1934. And, in 1934, the Vatican took the original issue from 1929 and surcharged it with new values. This set is very rare and will run about $2,000.
Turning to the papacy's coinage, what are some of the most memorable and unusual examples of coins minted in the past centuries? Which are the most valuable examples? And who are some of the famous artists who designed them? Alan Berman is an expert in medieval and papal coins and author of two books on the subject, Papal Coins and Papal Numismatic History. He began by explaining to me why he became fascinated by the history of papal coins.
I was brought to papal coins as a teenager by three things. One, I am a great fan of the Middle Ages, and I see the papacy as being the most intact medieval institution that Western civilization has preserved. There are many, many medieval institutions, but the papacy is essentially intact. Also, I am a great fan of Baroque art and the papal coinage, and even architecture, for that matter, is just a wonderful sampling of Baroque art. The coinage of the Rome Mint, especially in 1600s, is just beautiful. And lastly, and this is going to sound perhaps fairly trivial, I have since my childhood loved great big copper coins, and in the 16 and 17 and 1800s, the papal mint produced wonderful copper coins that looked like they could be milk chocolate candy bars.
But what are the earliest papal coins still in existence? Peter Jensis tells us more about when the long history of minting papal coins began.
That's a very good question. The coins of the Pope starts in the 8th century, and these earliest coins, sometimes they could be as simple as having the design of a cross on them. Later, they become more works of art, I think, certainly by the Renaissance, and so the papal mint has always used talented artists and engravers for their coins and medals.
Have there been any really famous names that have been used for this purpose?
Oh, well, no less an artist than Benvenuto Cellini made works for Clement VII in the 16th century, and Bernini would do so in the 17th century.
Now, on the front of a coin, there would usually be the bust of a pope. But what about on the reverse side? What have they included, you know, apart from presumably biblical scenes?
Yes, you're absolutely right. On the front or the obverse of the coin will often, most often, contain the name of the pope, certainly, and his year of reign. The reverse side, the popes did many things. They would use it for perhaps spiritual messages or to record their accomplishments.
Obviously, the election of a new pope was presumably the main prompter for minting a new set of coins. But what were some of the other notable reasons in the past centuries that spring to mind?
Well, you know, there are two major examples that come to mind. There's a special series of coins issued for each holy year or jubilee year. This occurs at least every 50 years and often more recently every 25 years. This would be the call for pilgrims to visit Rome and the holy basilicas. Now, the other special issue is the sede vacante issue. That stands for vacant seat. That's the period for which there is no pope, where the cardinals are in conclave looking to elect a new pope. For every period, coins and stamps are issued for that.
And I imagine those are very quickly snapped up, because obviously it's only a finite and fairly brief period.
Oh, absolutely right. Sometimes these periods can last less than 30 days.
Berman says the reverse sides of the papal coins are among the most varied and creative to be found on Western coinage. So in his view, what are some of the most striking designs?
One of the most inspiring coins is, in fact, the frontispiece of my book, Papal Coins. It's a 2.5 by oki piece struck in copper, which depicts St. Peter looking over his shoulder. At the same time, there were three different engravers designs being struck. Two of them are in fact quite boring, but one shows what it was like to be Peter in the first century when you knew that you were one of the leaders of a cult that was illegal and could get you killed. It really gives a sense of urgency, and I really regret that with radio you cannot actually see it, but it depicts him having a concerned expression. He's looking over his shoulder. He is holding the keys to the kingdom as though he were guarding it from Romans that would desecrate it. It's very, very inspiring. Another coin is very, very recent. By the way, the piece I just mentioned is from the 1790s. Another very inspiring piece is from the 1950 Holy Year, and it has the Dove of Peace flying before the Dome of St. Peter's. Those two certainly would be very, very inspiring art.
Let's return now to Peter Jensis to find out which are his personal favourites among the past designs on papal or Vatican coins.
I recall a small silver coin from Pope Pius XI and Pius XII that shows St. Peter in a boat amidst a storm. And this is an ancient or a very old Christian symbol of the boat as the church, guided by God and providing a source of refuge.
So in other words, these designs are often reflecting or giving us an insight into the mood or the burning issues of the period they came from. So presumably when that was minted, the church was felt to be going through a stormy period.
Well, certainly stormy periods are not uncommon. I think also the period when the Pope started to lose a lot of the land they controlled within Italy. This is in the 1800s.
The popes didn't just issue coinage, but they also issued medals, medallions, didn't they? Can you give us some examples of some of those? I gather, for instance, there was even one issued when Vatican Radio was set up.
That's absolutely right. The medals have a special tradition and an old tradition. It starts in about the 1400s, and later there would be a tradition for minting at least one medal every year that we call the annual medal. That tradition continues today. The Vatican Radio Medal is a very beautiful medal. That's in 1931. The medal was issued commemorating the opening. In fact, the Pope gave a gold version of this medal to Marconi for his efforts.
And what does it show?
Well, it shows angels flying above the radio tower.
Okay, well, yes, of course, Vatican Radio's patron saint is the angel Gabriel, so that's very appropriate. Coming to the makeup of the coins, in the past, I gather they were generally minted in precious materials, at least for the larger values like silver or gold or else copper and bronze. But nowadays, how many are still made of silver and gold? Just the commemorative ones? Should we say the everyday coinage is usually nickel alloys now, isn't it?
That's correct. The modern gold coins from the Vatican and silver are commemorative coins, and they're intended for collectors. But the mintages are fairly low. For example, recent gold issues, Vatican only minted about 2,800 per year.
But what are the main reasons that prompt people to collect papal or Vatican coins in the first place? Is it quite often for spiritual reasons? Alan Berman again.
I would say that is the second most popular reason that people collect papal coins. I think that the first reason that people offer to me is the quality of the art. It's just wonderful art, very often very inspired. It captures Renaissance art, it captures Baroque art, neoclassical, also very, very modern style artists, especially beginning with Paul VI. So the art really is the main feature that brings people into this field.
And which are the most valuable papal coins in existence? Let's go over once more to Peter Jensis.
Well, as you might guess, in the older coins and medals, gold, no surprise, tend to be the most valuable. And they're rare not only for their age, in many cases, but over the years, many coins and medals would have been melted, or there may have been some external factors. The French looted Vatican City around 1808, and no doubt many precious items were lost. As far as silver coins go, older coins can be quite large and have beautiful designs, as I mentioned, from famous artists. There's the coin of St. Peter that we talked about. There's one from around 1700, and a good example of this coin could cost $3,000 or so.
And when you say $3,000, is that the most expensive price for any papal coin, or are some of the prices even higher?
Oh, even higher. The gold coins and the gold medals can often run in the tens of thousands of dollars. That's no surprise, really, because in many cases there could be one or two examples of this coin that's or medal that survive.
I was speaking to Peter Jensis, a U.S. numismatist specializing in Vatican coins. And earlier you heard the voice of Alan Berman, an expert on papal coins and the author of two books on this subject. Thanks so much for joining us here on Vatican Radio. I'm Susie Hodges, and until next time, Laudato Jesus Christus.